Welcome back to Mountain Money. If you've tuned into any of the business shows over the last couple of months, or if you joined us last week, you've probably heard some discussion of the inverted yield curve and its relationship to possible recessions. We are really lucky this morning to have the godfather of the inverted yield theory, Professor Campbell Harvey, with us this morning to help us really understand it, because many of the times you hear it referenced on the shows, it's really pretty superficial and sort of hard to grasp. Good morning, Professor Harvey, and thank you for joining us.
Great to be on the show.
Professor Harvey, let's start with sort of a really basic concept of what is a yield curve and what does it represent in terms of the different kinds of bonds one can buy in the market?
Yeah, so the yield curve is simply the different interest rate that you would get for investing your money for different periods of time. So think of going into the bank and investing in a certificate of deposit. You would expect, if you locked up your money for 5 years, that the rate would be higher than if you locked up your money for 6 months. So the difference in rates here is known as the yield curve. And normally, that longer-term rate is higher than the short-term rate. And it turns out that today, it's inverted. It's backwards.
Well, and when we talk about inverted and the predictive, potentially predictive power, that's debatable, although it's had a good track record. We had a guest last week that I believe said that the inverted yield curve predicted, and whether that's 6 months to 2 years post, predicted 8 out of the last 8 recessions. So it's a pretty good track record to date. However, it's important to note, I believe that that's the difference between the 2-year and the 10-year. Is that correct? And is that part of the yield curve inverted?
So this is the way that I look at it. My dissertation in 1986 presented both a theory as well as empirical evidence that showed a relation between the yield curve and future economic growth. In my dissertation, I looked at the 10-year minus 3 months and the 5-year minus 3 months. Both were very similar in terms of what they delivered in terms of prediction. Since the publication of my dissertation, people have looked at different pieces of the yield curve. And some people have looked at, as you said, the 10-year minus the 2-year. And indeed, there's thousands of different pieces that you could look at. You can look at the 9.5-year minus the 7.5-year. The point here that I'm trying to make is my dissertation was published in 1986. It's got a long track record of working after the publication of my dissertation. It's not obvious why you would go to some other piece of the yield curve. The theory is very clear. The short end needs to be something that represents a quarter, and the 3-month Treasury bill represents a quarter. A 2-year Treasury bond doesn't. So the way I look at it is that the model has worked after the publication of my dissertation. It's not broken. You don't need to fix it if it's not broken. So I discount these other pieces of the yield curve as a result.
You know, I have a question about how you got to this theory. I mean, this is a pretty impressive PhD thesis. And just as a matter of personal curiosity, what led you to see this observation and to test it?
It's interesting that it was a summer job. I was an MBA student, and I went into the corporate development group of a large nickel and mining company based in Toronto. And as you know, the price of copper is highly cyclical. So it moves with the business cycle. And this company really needed some sense of what was going to happen in the future so they could plan their production. They could plan the mine openings and closings. So I was tasked with building an indicator for them that would give them some idea of when a recession would occur. And the first stop that I made was the stock market, because the stock market is a company's value depends upon its sales and profits in the future. So it's forward-looking. And there was a lot of research at the time in finance looking at the predictive power of the stock market, but it was just a classic situation where, yeah, it did have some ability to forecast the future, but it just famously gave so many false signals that it just wasn't reliable. And it wasn't reliable because the cash flows in the future, who knew what they were going to be? There was no maturity to a stock. Like, is it 10 years? Is it 100 years? Dividends are discretionary. And then I focused on something that also represented the future, a bond, but it was much more predictable. The coupons are fixed. The maturity and the principal is fixed. And it's a government bond, so we don't need to worry about default. So it just seemed to be a very clean sort of thing to use to get a glimpse into the future.
Boy, did that hiring company get their money's worth out of your summer. That's a huge task to ask a first-year MBA student. You know, give us a tool that nobody else, I mean, just to share with our audience, there really are no tools that are consistently predictive for something like this. If there were, it would be incredibly valuable. Your inverted yield curve theory has a great track record to date. So let's cut to the chase. You know, right now the yield on the three month is below the yield on the 10 years. Does that mean a recession's coming?
Yeah. So just to say it again. So it turns out that the yield on the 10 year is below the 3 month.
I'm sorry, I reversed that. Yep.
Yeah. So, and it has been for a full quarter as of yesterday.
Right. That's what we were going to ask, was did we make the full quarter through June 30th?
Yeah, and the five-year is also in the same situation where the five-year rate is below the three-month. So, again, both of those pieces of the yield curve have been inverted for a full quarter. So what does that mean? So it turns out that my dissertation linked real economic growth in the future to the magnitude of the yield curve. So my model says that there will be slower growth in the future. Empirically, we've seen that in the last seven from the late 1960s, seven recessions, each associated with an inverted yield curve before the recession started, including if I can immodestly say, famously, the global financial crisis. To call that one, that was a big deal, and my indicator got a lot of profile after that. And importantly, and this is very important because it kind of links to what I was saying about the stock market, I can deliver an indicator that forecasts every single recession perfectly if it is saying every quarter there's going to be a recession. So it'll get the seven recessions, but there'll be a huge number of false signals. And what's unique about this simple indicator is that there have been no false signals yet. So seven out of seven and no false signals. So, yes, we do have the red alert right now with a full quarter of inversion with both of the yield curve indicators.
Let's focus on that for a minute, because I think some of your previous publications over the last few months, I've seen you quoted as saying we have a flashing yellow light, because I think we were waiting for this full quarter. And now I hear you saying that because we now have a full quarter of inversion, that turns the yellow into red. How would you translate that, if you could, into a percentage likelihood of a slowdown next year?
Sure. So there's many different ways to actually do that. This is a very simple model. So looking at the historical data over the last 60 years, it's pretty clear. When the yield curve inverts, it's followed by a recession. So it's got 100% historical probability of predicting a recession. However, a model is just a model, and this model is a very simple one, just looks at one variable. Mm-hmm. And we know that the economy is very complex. So it is naive to say that there's 100% probability of a recession because things could change. So in terms of the probabilistic models that I look at and combining other information, and we can talk about that other information in a few minutes, but I put the probability of a recession happening in 2020 at over 50%.
Okay. So, and I'm glad you said that because I think it's important, right? Models are predictive and until they miss the first time. And there may very well be a time in the future. This may not be the time, but there likely will be a time in the future where it does give what's called a false positive. But the general theory behind it, you used the term earlier, you've used this term several times in our conversation, slowdown in economic activity. And there's a difference between a slowdown in economic activity and a recession. Our growth rate could slow. And to me, intuitively, it makes sense that the inverted yield curve would be an indicator of a slowdown of economic activity. Now, whether it can predict if it's going to go negative into the full definition of a recession is a different story. What are your thoughts on that?
So again, according to my model, economic growth will slow. So my model and my economic model in my dissertation is about forecasting economic growth. It's not about forecasting recession or no recession, though obviously the two are highly correlated. If you're forecasting negative growth, there's going to be a recession. So empirically, what we've observed is this model is very reliable, again, 7 for 7 over the last 60 years in predicting the actual recession. So let's put it another way. It is possible that we have much lower growth in 2020. Maybe it's 1%, maybe it's 0%, but we dodge an official recession. I would take that as a positive evidence of my model actually working. Indeed, I hope that we can have a sort of soft landing situation. So I hope that there's no recession. And again, to measure the viability of my model, you take a look at what happens to economic growth. And indeed, we've had some mild recessions. So the 2000-2001 recession was mild in that there was no year-over-year negative GDP growth. We had a few quarters with negative GDP growth, but no year-over-year. So that's the sort of recession that would be ideal. If we have to have a recession, we don't want to live through the global financial crisis again.
We do want to get to the other information you referenced, but I'd like to sort of take this back a minute and see if we can talk a little bit about why it is that this model would work. In other words, interest rates are set by behavioral choices in the market. People are making a decision. Can you talk a little bit about what you might think is the inverted yield curve represents as a predictor of a recession, if that makes any sense? I'm trying to understand why it works.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's an insightful question. And indeed, I had to answer that question very directly to my dissertation committee because that's their first question. And there's many different ways, and I present a detailed theory in my dissertation, but this is one way to think about how it works. If there in the market, amongst businesses, amongst consumers, people are worried about the future, they think there's a possibility of a recession or a crisis, there's usually a flight to quality. Mm. And when you talk about quality, the safest asset in the world right now is the U.S. 10-year Treasury bond. It is quality in quotations. So you can think of that flight to quality as increasing the demand for that bond, bidding up the price of the bond, and at the same time, the yield to maturity goes down. So this is a model that in a very elegant way captures the fears, the expectations in the market. And when that 10-year bond yield goes down, there's a greater chance of the yield curve inverting. That's exactly what we're seeing right now. And indeed, if you think the 2% yield on that government bond is really low, just look at some other markets. Right now, the UK 10-year bond is 0.8%. The German 10-year government bond is negative 0.32%. There's plenty of room for this inversion to get even bigger.
You know, and that all makes sense. What's really interesting is the foundation of that is the value of the signal received from the crowd, right? And if a house is burning and you see people running from the house, but you don't see this, you don't see the fire, you don't smell the smoke, you can be pretty sure, unless you're a trained fire person, you don't want to go into that building when everybody else is rushing out. So it's very predictive. In the stock market, in my business, the behavior of the crowd is often wrong. And what I find so fascinating about your study and the fact it has been so predictive is it is kind of based on the pricing of bonds are based on crowd behavior, what people are willing to pay for bonds, thus also the interest rates. How do you connect those two disparate points?
Yeah, so this is really insightful and linking to a previous point that I made. Regarding the stock market. So the stock market gives a lot of false signals because the cash flows, the dividends are uncertain. The time to maturity is uncertain, and the stocks are risky. But there's something else. So why would the bond market be a much cleaner indicator? So, you know, it's said that the maturity is fixed, the principal is fixed, and all this, but there's something else, and you hit it exactly, that the people that are transacting in the bond market are different than the people transacting in the stock market. We don't have the day traders in the bond market. We don't have the retail investors that might be influenced by the fad of the day. The people that are transacting in the bond market are sophisticated investors. They're often long-term investors that think deeply about positioning their portfolio for the future. So we don't have as much noise in terms of the trading that goes on in the bond market. And again, I refer to it as elegant, and I think it is, because you get rid of that noise. You see something that is much cleaner.
Earlier you touched on the concept of there is other information out there that help us identify a potential recession, and I know that you are heavily involved in the CFO, the Duke CFO survey. I saw a recent publication that you did back in March where you talked about the four horsemen of the next recession, which I'd be interested in talking a little bit about who those guys are and whether we're seeing them on the horizon.
Yeah, so back in March it was interesting because we had only three of the four horsemen officially out of the gate. And the fourth being the yield curve, which we've already talked about. It was flashing a warning sign, but it wasn't in the red zone. So let me go through the other three. Number one is, as you said, the Duke CFO survey. This survey has been going on for 25 years, and it's got a very good track record. And indeed, in the latest survey, it was basically the CFO saying that in 2020, there was a two-thirds probability of a recession. And these are the people that know the CapEx, that they know the employment plans like a year in advance. So that was flashing a red flag. And then the second one is anti-trade policies and anti-growth policies. And we've certainly seen a lot of that in the U.S., but it's not just the U.S. I think a bigger threat is what's happening with Brexit and the potential of Brexit of throwing the European Union countries into a recession. And what's bad for the European Union is bad for the U.S. And the third is just the amount of uncertainty in the economy is large right now. When there's uncertainty, businesses hesitate to make important investments, to make hiring plans, and things like that all slow growth.
Well,
so,
Professor,
you put all those together, it's four.
Okay. Professor Harvey, unfortunately, we need to wrap up, but very fascinating. Our guest this morning has been Professor Campbell Harvey. He is a professor of finance at the Fuqua School of Business, Duke University. Campbell, thank you very much for joining us. Very fascinating, and congratulations on such a powerful tool.
It was great to be on the show. Talk to you next time.
Okay. Thank you again. And before we go to break, I want to thank our great sponsors to Mountain Money. They include Mountain West Bank, Jans Mountain Outfitters, Park City Chamber Bureau, Columbus Pacific Development with Pendry and Apex Residences, San Francisco Design, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. Mountain Money will be back in a moment.
Joining the Park City Chamber Bureau provides your business with many benefits, including a listing on our highly visited website, business-to-business networking opportunities, discount programs for you and your employees, and advertising opportunities exclusively for our members. We support and provide resources to over 1,000 Park City area businesses, both large and small. More about joining the Chamber and growing your business, go to visitparkcity.com or 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
This is Brooks Arbertson, commercial lender for Mountain West Bank, sponsor of the amazing programming on KPCW. At Mountain West Bank, we offer consumer loan options as well as home loans and business loans in one location. Mountain West Bank, just off Kearns, next to the theaters. MountainWestBank.com, division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Our next interview was recorded last week by our co-host, Renee Bodley Miller. She had an opportunity to talk in person with Brian Shurkin, who's the president of Columbus Pacific Properties. We talked with Brian last December, and since he has so many projects in the works around town, we wanted to check in with him again and get a status report. Plus, he's got some big news about a new initiative for children he and his wife are introducing to the Park City area.
For the last 30 years, Columbus Pacific has developed apartment complexes, student housing, assisted living centers, and shopping centers all over the country. Here in town, they have redone the old Kimball Art Space in Park City, and at Canyons Village, they are about to break ground on the luxury property Pendry Residences while they wrap up their work on two other properties, Apex Residence and Viridian. Shurkin immigrated to this country more than 30 years ago, and he has some strong opinions about the immigration system in our country, and he's doing something about it. He tells Renee all about it. Here's her interview with Brian Shurkin, president of Columbus Pacific, which she recorded on Wednesday.
Ryan Shurkin, welcome and thank you for making time for KPCW's Mountain Money and our listeners.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
You know, our town has a love-hate relationship with guys like you. You bring in the great new hotels and the amenities and opportunities that go along with them, like the great restaurants and ski beaches and beautiful spaces that we like to take our out-of-town guests to. You also bring more tourists who bring more dollars to our economy, but with that comes growth and traffic, which, of course, we don't like. We talked to you on Mountain Money last December, and you mentioned how much you and your family love Park City. You live here full-time now or not quite yet?
We live here half-time.
Half-time.
Yeah, so we live in Park City half of the year and in Los Angeles the other half.
So how do you balance what you do for a living, develop these great properties, and balance that with what you love about where you live?
To be honest about it, when you're developing in Park City, you're absolutely not doing it for a living. I'm not sure that the returns that we get from these projects actually justify the risk and effort. We're really doing it from a place of passion, which is not to say we don't expect to generate a return, but I have to say that in the real estate business, there are a lot easier ways to make money. We absolutely love Park City. We've been coming here for 25 years. My kids learned how to ski in the Canyons Village, and we've had a home in Park City for 10 years. We love this place. We spend as much time here as we possibly can. We've dramatically increased the amount of time we spend here, and everything we're doing here is from the perspective is how do we enhance the experience for both the visitor and for the local community?
I'm surprised to hear you say that maybe the return on the investment isn't that great. This is your first foray into resort development. Is that correct?
Well, Apex really was our first foray. We've been building custom homes in Park City for about 10 years now. So we're very familiar with the market, the cost of construction, and the demand, and the margins associated with the construction that we've done. I will tell you that the reason we're doing it is because we love it. When my wife and I built our first home here, we had such a great time working with the architects and the contractors and the local community that we said, well, let's do this again. And my wife actually became a home builder. Her background is in the design industry, and we became co-developers. And every project we did it because we loved it. And we only built projects that we love building, which applies to what we're doing in the Canyons Village as well.
So let's talk about Apex Residences. It's a 63-unit condo project. Is it finished?
Apex will be finished right around the end of this year. 53 of the units have been sold. And residents have moved in to about 15 of the units already. It is an absolutely spectacular project. As far as we were concerned, it was in a location that really can't be replicated, right at the base of the mountain above the Canyons Village. And the fact that we were able to build a ski run through the middle of the property, which enabled residents to ski to the door of their units. There's actually a ski run that runs above the property, which enables the residents at the top level of units to ski into their units as well, enabled us to create something very special. In conjunction with that, we are great admirers and supporters of more contemporary architecture. The project has been very well received, which is reflected by the number of units that we've sold. I have to say it was somewhat of a risk when we started, because everybody told us that everybody still wants the traditional mountain house. We were very skeptical of that. We took a leap of faith, and we think we've built something that is really beautiful. I can tell you that there would have been less expensive projects to build on that site. It has two subterranean parking structures, so you see no cars on the site. It has the ski run that runs through the middle of it, and our goal was really to build something, you know, truly spectacular that we would be proud of forever, and I think that is the same is true of everything that we've built in Park City.
So that's a 63-unit project, and you said 53 have sold. For anyone listening, they want one of those 10 that's left over. What's the price point?
The prices range from about $1.8 million up to about $4 million, depending on the unit type. And we've also raised prices quite a bit from the beginning of the project because, you know, the initial buyers were willing to take a risk. They couldn't see what they were buying. They didn't know the quality of what we were going to build. And now that people have been able to see the project, I think that it has been received really well.
What ski run goes through there?
So it's actually a private ski run.
Oh.
Well, it's a new ski run.
And we're talking Canyons Village, right?
Yes.
And so as you go up the gondola, Red Pine Gondola, mm-hmm. you see Apex on the left.
That is correct, yeah.
Gotcha.
So if you were skiing down to the Hyatt and you took a left turn, you would ski through a newly created ski run that runs through the middle of our property, which would take you either to your unit or back down to the gondola.
And you're partnering with Vail on this, is that right?
So Vail is operating the property for us. They are running the rental program for the owners who choose to use them, and they are also managing the HOA and will manage the front desk as well and provide access to all of the amenities and benefits that being in a Vail-managed property provides.
So I'm a tourist. I want to come out here to ski Canyons Village. I want ski in, ski out. I go to the Vail website, and this would be one of the properties that would be available for rent?
That is correct, because many of the owners or the second homeowners in Park City like the idea of renting out their homes when they're not using them in order to offset the cost. For those owners at Apex, they have the opportunity to utilize Vail to rent those homes for them. And if you go to the Vail or Park City website and click residences, you will see the available Apex residences on the website. And we've actually been quite amazed at some of the rental rates that these units are getting. So the project is still incomplete and there's a lot of construction going on. But even with that, people have been paying really good rents for the units, which really inures to the benefit of the current owners.
Can you give us an idea of the range of those rents?
I can't offhand, but I know that I've been very surprised by how high they are, particularly over the festive season, Sundance and Presidents, because they're larger units and they're very few high-quality, larger luxury units in the marketplace.
So you've been in the development business for a long time. Is this standard operating procedure for you, where you build and develop and then someone else comes in and manages the property for you? Or are you normally the manager as well?
So there are certain properties that we do manage. But what we've learned in the hospitality and condominium business is that there's great value in being associated with a brand, because the brand makes a promise. And that's a promise of quality and service, which has to do with their heritage and their years in business. So I think that a renter knows that when they rent from Vail, they will get a certain level of service. When they rent from Pendry, which is a part of Montage, they will get a certain level of service. So the brand is very sensitive to the experience of its guest, which obligates it to deliver consistent and high-level service.
Let's move on to Pendry Residences. This is also Canyons Village. And new breaking news, today you secured a $165 million loan and closed on the land for Pendry Park City. Now, for those of us who aren't developers, can you put that in context? I mean, it seems like an awful lot of money to me.
Yes, it's a and to me as well. it's an enormous project. I think what that announcement reflects is the fact that this is a real project. I think a lot of people have come into this town and made lots of promises and not delivered. Our commitment is to deliver. Every project we've worked on, we've delivered on, and the people we work with and the partners we have make that commitment as well. So we've been working on the Pendry project for almost 2.5 years now, and that's really just the planning stage. We've made a tremendous investment in the architecture, design, engineering, guest experience, and really until you put your entire capital structure in place, I think people doubt whether you're actually going to build the project or not. We've actually announced our groundbreaking date, which is going to be July 19, and we invite everybody to come join us. It's going to be on the development site, which is the parking lot that is surrounded by the Sundial Lodge, the Hyatt, and the Hilton. And we've always had our eye on this lot. I mean, this lot is the heart of what should be the Canyons Village. And our goal is to build more than just a residential project on this site. It is to build the next generation of ski village. The property has 40,000 square feet of commercial space on the ground level. It has two levels of subterranean parking. It will be a true ski village with an après ski experience that doesn't currently exist in Park City. And that was always our goal, was to bring a level of ski experience to Utah that wasn't previously held, based on the experience that we've had as skiers in other places.
Now, that is something that resonated, I think, with a lot of our listeners when you mentioned that last December on our show. And you said this is going to be a ski village experience beyond anything that's available right now in the area. And it allows the customer to have the entirety of a ski experience without leaving the property. And as we talk about things like increasing traffic in our area, I think a lot of people's ears perked up with that.
That is correct. Although we do expect all of our guests to still engage with Main Street Park City, because the charm of Park City is really on Main Street. So what we see is our property enhancing the experience of the guest here, not at the expense of any other part of town. We've invested in Main Street, and we can talk about that in a little bit. We're big believers in Main Street. And what we believe is that what we're doing enhances the overall both guest experience and the overall economic benefit to the area. With the mountains combined, the Old Canyons Ski Resort and Park City combined, we expect that more guests will begin their ski day in the Canyons Village over time, because it actually provides a better entry experience into the mountain than Park City Village does, both based on the amount of traffic trying to get into Park City Village on a powder day, and the amenities that will be available in the Canyons Village. What we're creating will supplement the existing village. We don't expect to eliminate what's currently in the village. We expect to be able to work with the stakeholders in the village to enhance the experience in the existing village, to provide a much greater variety of experience to the guest. Plus, what people need to keep in mind is that this is just the initial stage of the development of Canyons Village. There will be multiple other projects developed around the core, some of them hopefully by us and some by other developers, and there are other developers developing there right now, which will provide a much more comprehensive experience over time.
Well, I was going to ask you that when you said there's a lot more to be developed there. Any other projects that you have your eye on? You can announce it here first.
So, yeah, I mean, we're working on a number of projects in the village because we're so passionate about the village and the experience that can be delivered there. We also love building in the county because in the Canyons Village, there is a master plan that exists. And as long as you build within the constraints of the master plan, you have a very predictable path forward. Our relationship with the county is terrific. They're very supportive. Our relationship with Vail is terrific. Our relationship with the landowner is fantastic. And that delivers a very predictable path to us, which as a developer is very important. So yes, we do have our eye on other parcels. No, I'm unable to announce any of them yet, because once we announce something, we're going to do it.
Well,
there's still quite a bit of uncertainty, I would say, around some of the other things we're looking at. But once we get to a greater level of certainty, we'll certainly provide more specifics.
We'll have you back on the show for that.
Certainly.
Just to tick off a couple boxes for our listeners about Pendry Residences in Canyons Village, it's 150 unit, and you're selling all 150 units, and they have lockouts for rentals. Is that right?
That is correct. So the number is actually increased to 152 units. 83, I believe it is, of the units have lockouts, which enable the owners to rent their units out in multiple ways. So, for example, if it's a three-bedroom unit with a lockout, it can be rented as a three-bedroom, a two-bedroom, a studio. So it provides a lot of flexibility to the owner in terms of generating revenue on their unit. The entire project is going to be managed by Pendry, which is part of Montage. And a big part of the reason we went with Pendry is because of their relationship with Montage, because the Montage promise in Park City has been lived up to in every single way. I think when anybody goes to Montage, they know exactly what they're going to get. It's going to be the highest level of service. The Pendry experience is differentiated from Montage in some very interesting ways. So,
how so?
Pendry is part of the trend in hospitality that is known as what they call new luxury, which moves away from the traditional five-star hotel that Montage is. So we expect to deliver an equal level of service and in many ways a higher level of experience by creating a project that is much more architectural. So our architecture will be much more contemporary than Montage and much more activated. So the energy of our project will incorporate a lobby lounge that we expect many, many people to be sitting in, eating, drinking, hanging out, engaging. The project has five restaurants, all of which are around a plaza, one of which is at the rooftop pool, which will be the only rooftop pool in Park City, which, by the way, we expect to become the number one wedding location in Park City.
And all of this will be done, you believe, by 2021? Is that
yes.
right?
Yes. The whole project is being built at one time.
It are you not selling it now?
Yes. So we started our pre-sales in February. We took reservations on almost $100 million of units in the first 3 months of our pre-sales. So we were incredibly excited by the way the community responded to the product we were building. We think a lot of that has to do with how unique it is, with its location, with its activation. The property also has a full-service spa. It has a kids club. It'll have a family restaurant.
So how many units do you have available left to sell?
We've sold about 50% of the project already. So there are about 75 to 80 units still available.
Still available. Ranging, price point?
Ranging from a studio, which can be purchased for around $400,000, to a four-bedroom penthouse for around $3.7 million. So what we did here is we delivered a wide variety of product at a wide variety of price point in order to make it accessible to the greatest number of buyers in the marketplace.
So a lot of projects happening at Canyons Village. There was your first project, I believe, in town, the Old Kimball Art Space here in Old Town. You talked about what a great relationship you have with the county. Let's talk about the challenges you faced with Kimball. Developing in Old Town, I think anyone who knows Old Town, is a lot more challenging. Where does that project stand now, and how did you get involved in that space to begin with?
we believe that this is the best located project on Main Street, Park City, and the most underutilized corner. We felt that it created a gap in the continuity of Main Street between Upper and Lower Main Street, and by filling in the gap with a very high-quality project, we would be able to connect the two parts of Main Street. And I think we've been successful in doing that by creating what we consider to be a really beautiful building. And I'm going to do a shout-out here to Craig Elliott, who did the architecture for us. And so we're very proud of what we created over there.
For our listeners, just for some perspective, this is where L.L. Bean is now. And then on the Heber Avenue side, it is We Norwegians, which is a store there. And then it will be an event space?
It is an event space. So on the upper level of the project is a permanent event space. And we created that because we felt there was a real shortage of great space on Main Street available for groups coming into town, for weddings, for events, for Sundance. And we felt like the demand for a space on Main Street would be really great. And that's actually proven out to be true. The event space is open, and we've had some really phenomenal events in the space. So we're very excited about that. We work with Culinary Craft, who manages the space for us and handles all the catering. And for anybody who's experienced their catering, they are absolutely fantastic.
Were you surprised about the reaction of the town about noise on a rooftop patio?
Absolutely, because we generate far less noise than the street generates. So the buses, the cars, et cetera, generate way more noise than our project generates. Now, we've done a bunch of noise studies. We're working through a process with the city. I'm quite sure the outdoor area will be open for events quite soon. And we couldn't be more excited about the project. We love it.
So this is the first summer that that rooftop event space will be open?
That is our expectation.
And so we haven't had an event there yet?
That is correct.
Okay, but you've had indoor events?
We have had many indoor events.
Were you at all interested in the Park City Mountain Resort parking lot development? Was Columbus Pacific, did you express interest to Vail about developing that area?
We really didn't because we have limited resources, and our goal is to focus on projects where we have a very predictable path forward. We weren't confident that the path forward on that project was highly predictable. We also have our hands full in the Canyons Village and feel like we have established relationships in the Canyons Village that enable us to develop really great product there. And with the limited resources we had, we decided to focus our areas in Canyons Village.
Let's move on to immigration. We've got about 5 minutes left in this interview, and I stumbled upon an editorial that you wrote in the Salt Lake Tribune last summer. Immigrants help build the cities that make Utah shine. Let's embrace them. You're an immigrant yourself.
Yes, I am. So I immigrated to the United States about 36 years ago now from South Africa. I love this country. I love everything that it has offered me, all of the opportunity I've had here, the family I've built here, the friends, the relationships, the business. I love everything about the opportunity that this country has delivered to me. And I am personally feel very strongly about the lack of immigration policy in our country and the divergence of opinion on both sides of the immigration issue and our inability to come up with policy that enables our country to succeed and grow. I'm also distressed about the demonization of immigrants in the United States, particularly in relation to the fact that the vast majority of them come here for the same opportunity that I came here for, and they're working to make a better life for their families. And when we look at it in a local context, of the vast majority of workers in the hospitality industry being immigrants or families of immigrants, and the fact that they don't have access to basic resources, to me is just unacceptable. So when we began spending much more time in Park City and wanted to engage in the community in a greater way, we reached out to the Park City Community Foundation about where they felt the greatest need for immigrants in the community was. And where they felt it was in the area of kids between the ages of 0 and 3. Most of whom have two working parents and their families and are put into informal daycare. And what that really means is that they sit in a child seat in front of a television set for 8 hours a day. And
at somebody's private home, probably with a lot of other kids.
That is correct. Yeah. And what that results in is kids going into kindergarten that are unprepared. They don't have the language skills, the social skills, the academic skills to succeed, and the vast majority of them never catch up. And the dropout rates of these kids in high school are dramatic, in some cases over 70%. And we felt that a small investment at this stage of their development would result in an enormous cost saving at a later stage and their ability to contribute to our community in a much greater way later. So in conjunction with the Park City Community Foundation and two phenomenal organizations that they work with, the Holy Cross Ministries and the NPC TOTS, we committed ourselves to help them solve the problem.
What are you doing?
So we have put a strategy in place with the Community Foundation, and we made the lead gift toward executing the strategy to eliminate the waiting list. There's a waiting list of up to 100 kids between the ages 0 and 3 looking to access preschool facilities, and we have enabled them to hire coordinators and leaders of this initiative and to put the fundraising mechanisms in place that will raise $1 million over the next 2 years to eliminate this issue and to put the infrastructure in place to ensure that this issue is eliminated long term. So we're very involved in our community and community organizations in Los Angeles, and we don't believe in just writing checks, although we do that. We believe, my wife and I believe in engaging hands-on in helping to solve the problems, which is what we've done in partnership with the Community Foundation. I hope to be sitting here 2 years from now telling you that every kid between the ages 0 and 3 has access to an early child care facility and has access to a program that the Holy Cross Ministries delivers, which is the Parents as Teachers program, where they educate parents as to the needs of their children and identify issues with children at a very early stage.
When you say we are doing this, you mean you and your wife?
That is correct. In partnership with the Community Foundation. We know we couldn't do this on our own. We both have full-time jobs. And the Community Foundation has just been a fantastic partner. They have a finger on the pulse of the community needs, the organizations that help to meet those needs, and the relationships to put together a coalition to solve the problem. So, for example, this coalition that we've put together in conjunction with them includes all of the ski mountains in the area and most of the major hotels in the area, because these are the people that are employing the members of the community that are most affected by this issue and who will most benefit by the problem being solved.
Are there any other steps you're taking? You had this editorial about immigration last summer. You're now doing this with early childhood efforts in our own community. Have you reached out to members of Utah's congressional delegation or any other elected leaders? Are you doing some behind-the-scenes work, which by answering that question would no longer be behind the scenes?
Absolutely. So I am very actively engaged on the political level in Utah. I have to commend one congressman from Utah who has been at the forefront of this issue, and that is Ben McAdams, who we have created a wonderful relationship with and who is very passionate about the issue of immigration and early childhood education. And we have also engaged with the Chamber of Commerce on this issue in Salt Lake, and they're very active on the issue as well because they realize that it inhibits all businesses from succeeding, no matter what industry they're in. We see it in the development business where there is a massive shortage of labor to construct the projects we're looking to build. What that results in is either projects not being built or being built at a cost that doesn't really support their development. But regardless of the industry, everybody is affected by the low unemployment rates that we have and the shortage of labor to grow their businesses. So we know that by embracing the economic argument for immigration, it crosses political denominations, which is really our goal. Our goal is really to try to elevate this above the political fray and present this as something that benefits all of us and engage with politicians on all sides of the aisle and members of the community, regardless of what their politics are, because we all benefit by enabling immigration of capable people who will fill jobs that are currently open and ensuring that those communities have access to critical services. So this is something that benefits everybody. The political environment is tough. We don't expect dramatic change to be imminent, although We have seen some headway just in the last couple of weeks. I work with an organization that's based in New York called New American Economy, which was funded by Michael Bloomberg, that advocates for immigration reform based on fundamental economics. And as a result of their lobbying and also the support of the two senators from Utah, in the next couple of weeks, we will see significant reform of the H-1B visas, which will enable country-specific caps to be eliminated, which is created a major barrier to entry. So there is some progress being made at the political level, but it is slow. So we focus a lot of our energy on the grassroots because we know at that level we can bring about change in a relatively short period of time.
We've been talking to Brian Shurkin, president of Columbus Pacific. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for having me. I've really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Carissa here, owner of Estee Pizza Park City and delighted to support KPCW. Located at 1781 Sidewinder Drive, Estee Pizza offers New York-style pizza, sandwiches, salads, as well as vegan and gluten-free items. Open daily for lunch and dinner and patio dining available. 435-731-8970. Menu selections at esteepizzaco.com.
White Pine Touring, proud sponsor of KPCW, offers guided outdoor adventures for all ages and abilities, including mountain biking, road biking, hiking, and rock climbing excursions, each tour designed to fit your ability and time frame. Bike rentals, sales, service, and weekly trail rides. White Pine Touring, get into the outdoors, 649-8710 or whitepinetouring.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Special thank you again to Renee Bodley for that fabulous interview.
And we also want to thank our guest today, Professor Campbell Harvey, who talked to us about the inverted yield curve, and Brian Shurkin, who talked to us in a wonderful interview with Renee Bodley Miller. Next week on Mountain Money, we have a really interesting program coming up. Betsy Atkins, the author of Be Board Ready, The Secret to Landing a Board Seat and Being a Great Director. We'll also have Jason Barrett, the director of food and beverage at the Stein Erickson Lodge, a place that all of us love to eat, and we'll also be able to talk about fine wines with Mr. Barrett.
Wine and food and other interesting subjects. So you're not going to want to miss next week. Take a look out the window. This beautiful weather that you see today is, as far as the eye can see, into our forecast, which my phone gives me 10 days worth of weather. It should be more of the same. So go out and enjoy the summer. It is finally here. We also want to thank our visitors that are here for the 4th of July. Park City has a great 4th of July parade. If you haven't been, you definitely want to you definitely want to go and see that, and thank you to all the volunteers. It takes a lot of people to put on an event like that.
We do get a lot of people here on the 4th of July, and that it's a wonderful, wonderful event, but one of the things that comes with that is traffic. And we here at KPCW will be broadcasting traffic reports during the day on the 4th of July to help you keep up with what's going on. We'll also be playing some patriotic music on the 4th to accompany the celebration of our independence.
And we'll also be encouraging you to take public transportation to the 4th of July events. And be aware that the buses are oftentimes full, so just plan ahead. Just quick update, the market is up, so things are looking good out there. Thank you for joining us this morning on Mountain Money.